Part 2. The Bark of Ra. Chapter 7. Shivago. Seer Hunter. Men of Ice.
"This is the one?" asked Diopromus.
"Yes, assuming Uexkul's last exlode is correct," said Majos Fidens, scrolling through the Shivago's manifest on his data slate and checking it against the alphanumeric stenciled on the bulkhead. "Deck 169 Alpha Medicae Astartes, Triage Station 1200.
"Yes."
"Then this should be Verastus Cirillo."
"What's his Electu serial code?"
19 Corvus Lambda 27 6th of the 10th 51st 10235.
Promus nodded and inspected the candidate critically. The unconscious legionary lay on a steel gurney in a portion of the Shivago set aside for Legiones Astartes casualties en route to Terra. Too badly hurt for field apothecaries to repair, not damaged enough for a dreadnought frame, and far too valuable to be left to die. 64 other legionaries shared this vaulted space, some freshly dead, most with wounds so awful they existed in that liminal space where life and death were indistinguishable. Verastus Cirillo was naked, but for a grubby sheet draped across his midriff. His wounds were many and deep, and all to the fore. Sweat beaded his taut skin as transhuman biology worked unknowable miracles within to knit broken bones, renew ruptured organs, and weave flesh. A swept-winged raptor, tattooed across Cirillo's ribless torso, told Promus he was Ravenguard. Even without the tattoos, skin pallor revealed his heritage.
"No matter how many alien suns they see, the suns of Korax never darken," said Promus. "I wonder, flaw or birthright?" "A legacy of their sire," said Videns.
"Indeed," said Promus, pressing his fingertips to the carved ivory of Cirillo's bicep.
"Yet another reason to be thankful that Lord Gilliman's blood flows in my veins."
He let a fraction of psi power bleed from his mind, sending a bioelectric pulse through the warrior's skin. The muscle rippled as invisible etchings formed temporary ridges of scar tissue, revealing the subdermal Electu.
19 Corvus Lambda, 27 6th of the 10th, 51st 10235, confirmed Promus. "I could have used haptics to confirm that," said Videns. "I know how you dislike..."
"No," said Promus. "If I cannot bear the touch of a brother legionary's skin, how will I endure a connection to his mind?"
"As you wish," said Videns with a curt bow.
The subdued light of the Medicaid deck reflected from the statisticator's chromed cog mask. Two vertical slits of an augmitter served as a mouthpiece, and instead of eyes, a rotating selector held a collection of brass-framed loops. A floor-length robe hung on Videns in a way that suggested his body plan owed nothing to conventional anatomy. Promus set aside his skull-top staff and reached up to unsnap his helmet seals. The smell of the infirmary ship assailed him immediately, a toxic melange of stagnant blood, rotting flesh, soiled bindings, mud from a dozen worlds, counterseptic and sweat. But the smells would not be the worst of it. Not by a long way.
"Step back, Videns," said Promus.
The Magos did as instructed, knowing to keep his distance from the librarian at moments like these. Promus removed his helm and his vision grayed as the armor relinquished its input to his mortal senses. The shimmering crystalline matrix of the psychic hood worked into the rear curve of his burnished gray plate dimmed. Pain rammed into his mind, hard, straight up the spine. It stabbed his joints with hot nails, filled his lungs with blood-frothed matter. It splintered his bones to powder and stabbing glass. It split the meat of his limbs as earth opens before a plowshare and ran molten from his body like heated wax. It crackled on flash-burned skin and rotted him from the inside with gangrenous corruption. phantom sensation and psychic echoes, but no less traumatic. Just under 7,000 wounded souls were listed on the infirmary's ship's manifest, and Promus felt every scrap of their pain. He willingly took it all. His mind screamed with it, a sparking circuit board that ran the gamut of suffering from purely physical pain to the anguish of limbs lost, senses ripped away, and hideous deformity carved in storms of hot shrapnel. Promus rammed a fist into the bulkhead, crumpling the inches-thick steel. His eyes locked wide, his teeth ground against one another like tectonic plates crafting mountain ranges. Engorged veins and straining sinews swelled and stood proud on his neck. He could dissipate the pain into his hood, free himself from the suffering of those around him, but he did not. Pain was a gift, and to feel it was to nurture it, to gird his humanity to the awful necessity of the burden he bore, a blood price he paid willingly. Promus exhaled and unclenched his fists. The pain was still there, but it was part of him now. Manageable. Better, it gave him a way in.
"Librarian," said Videns.
Promus nodded and let out a shuddering breath.
"Tell me,"
he said.
Videns consulted his slate. "Cognitive diagnostics suggest a high probability of psychological suitability, though Legionary Cirillo's records are far from complete."
"Only to be expected," said Promus. "The 19th do not easily submit to such evaluations."
"His last?" "The last verified evaluation was 5 standard years before the Istvan infamy."
"Your analysis?"
"My initial statistical prognostication still stands," said Videns. "Legionary Cirillo's latent psychic traits and genetic markers suggest minimal imagination, a propensity for dogmatic thought, and an almost slavish devotion to duty."
"There is nothing slavish about the 19th.
A mere turn of phrase, that his genetic predispositions say otherwise."
"Genetics do not tell of a life," said Promus.
"Only by his deeds can a warrior be damned or proven." "Be that as it may, I am confident Legionary Cirillo will be a worthy candidate for the Sigillite's program," said Videns.
Promus drew on the power within him, power he had once used with pride as chief librarian of the Ultramarines Legion, but which now marked him as dangerous. He placed his hands either side of Cirillo's head, and the warrior moaned, his mind already sensing the presence of an intruder. Past experience told Promus a space marine's mind was a steel-toothed trap. Subtlety was pointless. He let out a breath and rammed his consciousness into Cirillo's mind, a clawing trawl of his warrior soul, and a bloody tide of memory and experience roared over him. Wars waged and enemies slain, brothers lost and honour tarnished, the world of Black Sands, Istvan V, a name of cursed provenance, a new byword for treachery. Raining blood, fire and steel screaming from the sky, a shout of betrayal from 10,000 guns, trusted friends now bitter foes, pain and torment, a father fallen, lost or dead, who could say? Pain warred with loss, a thirst for vengeance. The massacre of the Urgal Depression overshadowed all else. The desperate flight, days of hopelessness, days trapped on a world where everything sought his death, nights of being hunted by clicking horrors from the shadows that knew the dark better than he ever would. Then, ships out of the void, deliverance from afar, hope the fight was not lost. Then despair as hope burned. Shattered legions fighting to their last breath. No hope save death in battle. Vengeance. Always vengeance. 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 The raw purity of it. Striking and killing. Bathing in the blood of those who had betrayed the Emperor. A hunger that could never be sated. A thirst that could never be quenched. Vengeance! Promus withdrew from Veristus Cirillo's mind. His hands felt burned. He snatched them back, fingers spread wide. Violent urges were a roaring storm in his skull. He threw back his head and howled, a primal shout as potent as any loosed by the rout. His hood blazed, the psi matrix burning phosphor bright as it dissipated the psychic aftershocks of his mental union with Veristus Cirillo. Promus's heart thundered in his chest. He willed its jackhammer rhythm to slow, expelling the rushing tide of aggression in sweat and shuddering breaths. His vision bled crimson, his breath hot with fury, the urge to kill drained by degrees. Promus shook his head. "You were wrong," he said.
"Wrong,"
said Major Svidens.
"Every aspect of statistical probability suggested Veristus Cirillo was perfect."
"Perhaps he was," said Promus. "But Istvan broke him. He is damaged, consumed by a need for revenge."
"Few of your kind are not,"
pointed out Videns. "My vengeance will be had when Horus lies dead at the Emperor's feet," said Promus.
"I do not reckon it simply by the tally of foes reaped. Cirillo's thirst for vengeance is a temptation, and temptation is weakness." "A small weakness, surely."
Promus shook his head.
"A warrior's worth can be measured greater or lesser, but no weakness can be counted small.
Not now, not with so much at stake. The chosen of Titan must be beyond temptations. All temptations." Videns stowed his slate within the folds of his robes and bowed to Promus.
"Apologies, Librarian Promus,"
he said.
"I had high hopes for this incursion, but it seems I was wrong."
Promus spun and hauled Videns from the deck, residual pain fueling his anger at the statisticator's error.
"Do you understand what your being wrong has cost? Do you? Think of all this warrior could have done, every traitor he might yet have killed. Do you truly understand?"
Videns struggled in the librarian's grip, his inhuman anatomy squirming beneath his robes. A bark of fear squalled from his augmeter.
"Librarian Promus, please! Statistical prognostication, for all its empirical clarity, is not perfect." "Your previous assertions speak to the contrary,"
said Promus, tightening his grip.
"Numbers do not lie when you are proven correct, but are conveniently imperfect when you err." "No method of prognostication is without its flaws,"
said Videns in a rush.
"Prophecy, augurs, horospicy, cartomancy, all are subject to interpretation and variations."
Promus had not the stomach for Videns' excuses and increased the pressure on the half-man's neck still further. Metal deformed with a groan of plasteel and the hiss of straining pneumatics. The brass loops on the tech priest's faceplate spun frantically.
"Librarian!"
cried Videns.
"He wakes!"
Promus dropped the Magos to the deck, knowing the anger he felt was misplaced and not entirely his own. He saw his own face reflected in the brushed steel of Viden's mask and turned away in disgust. Veristus Cirillo was stirring, his eyelids fluttering as the violation of his memories overcame the biological mechanisms keeping him sedated. He groaned, fists bunching as combat glands doused his muscles in stims. Promus laid a hand on Cirillo's skull, almost tenderly.
"Forgive me, brother,"
he said, then vaporized the legionary's brain with thoughts of fire. They left the chambers of the Medicae Astartes. Promus sealed the doors behind him with profound regret. The shadowed hall beyond was dark and silent, no longer a place of healing, but a sepulchre.
"Damn you, Malkador,"
he whispered, placing his hand on the door's cold metal. His eyes fell upon the dull silver of his arm. The curve of his vambrace was gunmetal grey, no longer the cobalt blue of the 13th. The removal of his legion colours had been traumatic, but at times like this he was glad of their absence. His brothers in Ultramar would never countenance the cold logic of Malkador's plan. They would see what was done here as a gross betrayal, but they did not know what he knew. They had not seen what he had. They had not listened to Magnus the Red's grandiloquence as he stood in the arena of Nicaea and refuted the accusations of sorcery laid against him. Promus remembered that day all too well. Volcanic heat, reflections in vitrified glass labyrinths, righteousness swelling within his breast as he stood shoulder to shoulder with his fellow warrior mystics, Elikas, Umogen,
Sarost, chief librarians all, and Targutai Yasugai, foremost storm-seer of the White Scars. The Trigorian had spoken with the wisdom of Ptolemy, and the odd syntax of his savagely accented Gothic belied the insight of his words. Each librarian had added to Yasugai's oration, building an argument founded on logic, reason, and evidence. But they had been deceived. Even Yasugai, wisest amongst them, had not seen what Magnus concealed behind his mask of good intent. Promus's gauntlet clenched into a fist. "You lied to us," he whispered through gritted teeth. The master of the Arethusa, Magos Umwelt Uexkul, met them in the stained glass narthex of the Medici decks. He watched the spindle-limbed Vorax automata prowling the Shivago's infirmary vaults, his steel-dust body draped in the shadow of a statue representing a wounded soldier and the Emperor. More accurately, Uexkul's cybernetic proxy awaited them. Wrought from modified Lorica Thalax exo-armor and Castellan parts, this Ursurax was a mechanized shock trooper of pneumatic limbs and fiber bundle muscles. No mere robot, its augmented combat chassis was normally hardwired to the excised cerebrum and nervous system of an indentured tech thrall. The High Magos himself remained aboard the Arethusa, an atrophied revenant of neurodegenerative maladies entombed within a mobile gibbet harness. In lieu of physical presence, Uexkul projected his consciousness into the hulking Ursarax's war body through the mystic arties of cybertherapy. The orange-lacquered Ursarax looked up as Promus and Videns approached, soft light from the electro-flambeau dancing across its metallic body. Painted serpents writhed across the gleaming piston-driven armor, and someone had painted a crimson skull across its faceplate. Mind impulse cables ran in cornrows across the elongated crown, linking Uexkul's sensorium to the brutalized cortex within. Promus hated Uexkul's proxy. The constant agony of the living being enslaved within left a raw, bloody taste in his mouth, as though he were chewing glass splinters.
"Where is the candidate?" asked Uexkul,
his voice a patchwork assembly of previous vox samples that were all that remained of his once stentorian tones. "He was not suitable."
"Regrettable," said Uexkul. "Disposal protocols apply. Vorax contingents have the crew quarantined in the lower decks ready for termination, and I have exloaded instructions for a random warp jump to the Shivago's logic engines."
The anger that almost ended Viden's surged through Promus, but his psychic hood swiftly dissipated the sensation. On a ship of wounded souls, where suffering and misery abounded, strong emotions were blood in the water to the things beyond the veil. He took a breath and turned from the proxy.
"Do what you must. I am done here."
"Not so," said Uexkul. "A ship draws near."
The stitched-together syllables made it hard to lift any nuance from Uexkul's voice, but Promus immediately sensed his displeasure that this ship was in such close proximity.
"How did it get so close without us detecting it?"
"Because it is the Doramar," said Uexkul. "Rumour has it that a warrior of the 19th has its helm."
Promus cursed silently.
"Nagasena is here," he said.
The hazed curve of the planet of the sorcerers slid from the Oculus Bay as the Kemet turned its prow away. Ahriman watched it diminish with curious sadness.
"I hate the world you brought us to," he said under his breath. "But each time I leave, I fear I might never return."
The Kemet's command bridge tapered to the elliptical Oculus, with heavy beams of Prosperine serpent wood following the golden ratio as they arched over flagstones of dark slate. Polished granite busts of previous shipmasters rested in crystalline sepulchres, their haughty gaze ensuring each successor was worthy of commanding so fine a vessel.
Legion warriors and bronze-armored thralls stood before marble obelisks, cut with glyphic formulae and set with glowing data slates. Each thrall boasted an empty eye socket, a self-inflicted devotion where a shard of Tiscan glass had gouged away the orb in imitation of the Crimson King. At the heart of the bridge was the Kemet's scrying pool, sunk in a tiled shaft before the oculus bay. Menkaura and Sanakt stood whispering at its edge, looking down to where a conjoined ring of shaven-headed neophytes encircled the pool. These were the envisioned, elevated thralls who read the tides of the great ocean echoing within the restless waters of the pool to guide the vessel. Pavoni Artes had rendered their faces eyeless and fused the bones of their hands together in an unbroken seance circle.
"Do we have a vector?" asked Araman.
"We have a heading to take us out of the eye," said Menkaura, without turning from his study of the pool. "But neither I nor the envisioned see a specific destination. It is most vexing."
Araman nodded and returned to the shipmaster's throne, where the Book of Magnus lay chained upon the command lectern. He placed a hand upon his Primarch's grimoire, feeling the immense power within. Beyond the power, he felt the yearning for wholeness, a yearning inextricably linked to the mortal whose hand had written it.
"Mahavastu, Callimachus," he whispered. "Is that who we will find on this first road?"
"Azek,"
said Menkaura. Araman looked up.
"A heading is all we need for now," he said. "What I saw in the Pyramid of Fotep will guide our steps towards the first of our sire's soul shards."
Already Araman felt the thrumming tension in the Kemet's superstructure, a guided flow of ether energy borne from prow to stern by crystals grown in the reflecting caves and Athenaean raptures inscribed in every bulkhead.
"Your ship feels it too," said Aphogomon,
emerging from the shadows at the rear of the command bridge. The demon's yokai body stood behind Araman's throne.
"The potential of this moment fills its steel bones. It strains to be underway."
The presence of the bound demon was a dull ache in Araman's soul, one he had unsuccessfully tried to ignore. His first instinct had been to break the invocatus bindings on the yokai's skull and cast the demon out. But Magnus's will in this matter was clear.
"Your hate for me is palpable," said Aphogomon. "But you know you will fail without me. Can the same be said for the others in this ragged host you have assembled? Fulgrim's treacherous bladesmen, fellow warbands whose only connection is that they witnessed their father fall a second time, and a pair of insane god-engines, not to mention the beasts and renegades. If this rabble is what Magnus believes will save him, then the Lords of Ruin chose wisely when they made Horus Lupercal their champion."
"Do not speak his name," said Araman. "You don't get to say the Crimson King's name in my presence."
"And what of the others you will betray?"
said Aphogomon in a playful whisper.
"What of Mamunim and Caillou, Menkaura, Sanakt and Hathormat? Do I get to say their names?"
"What are you talking about? They are my brothers. I would never betray them."
"Now they are your brothers," agreed the demon. "But who can say what they will be to you in a few months' time, or a year? What will they be to you in 10 years, or even 10,000 years? Surely you are not arrogant enough to imagine you will enjoy the Primarch's favour forever. You must know others vie for your exalted position."
Aphogomon moved around the throne and took a seat next to Araman, upon the stone bench reserved for the Kemet's first officer, traditionally an adept of the Athenaeans.
"Do you recall Shrike?"
asked Aphogomon. The abrupt change of tack surprised Araman.
"You mean Heliosa?"
The demon waved a dismissive hand. Araman noted the paint peeling back on its digits, the corruption of the thing within manifesting without.
"An insipid name when a far bloodier one suits what happened there so much better. But yes, Heliosa, where Magnus and Layman Russ almost came to blows before the great library."
"Of course I remember that world. What of it?"
"It was a planet rich in unique flora and fauna," said Aphogomon. Or at least it was before the word-bearer's fleet bombed it to dust a year after you left.
That caught Ahriman's attention.
Lorgar destroyed Heliosa.
Yes. Didn't you know?
No.
Afagoman shrugged, as if the destruction of an entire planet was a matter of little consequence.
Then this may interest you. Among the planet's many, now extinct, species was a particularly vicious breed of raptor that nested in Clifftop Eyries on Phoenix Crag's northern coastline. A mother raptor produced 3 chicks from every clutch of eggs. No more, no less. And she would watch her newborns to see which chick emerged the strongest. After a few days, one would turn on its siblings, trying to push them out of the nest. The weaker chicks fought back, of course, but in the end they were defeated and fell from the nest to die.
The mother let one of her offspring murder the others.
Afagoman nodded.
She would coolly observe this life-or-death struggle, but she would never intervene, waiting to see which of her offspring was most worthy to fly at her side.
Ahriman smiled at the transparency of the demon's gambit.
Magnus may have given you a new body, said Ahriman, but this attempt to sow discord is farcical.
The minutiae of mortal interactions are yet new to me,
laughed the unapologetic demon, the sound hideously vital for something mechanical, something the very antithesis of life.
It is the curse of all things to be true to their nature.
Your lies will not work on me, said Ahriman.
The demon traced the lines cut into its mechanized body, as though contemplating what falsehood to attempt next.
You should know that my essence is a much feared aspect of the Pantheon. What the Neverborn Seers call fate-woven, pure unpredictability and chaos. All ages of great change are chains of fate-woven moments, instants where the smallest decision will have enormous consequences. A thing expected to be negative will actually be positive. Something assumed constant is revealed to be finite. What mortals believe to be eternal suddenly vanishes. Even you must see that this is an age of fate-woven times like no other.
The demon leaned towards Ahriman, close enough for him to smell the sour reek of the magics binding it and see the perfect patterning of the grooves cut in its ceramic body.
My essence of chaos is the bane of seers, said Afagomon. So the only sane response to fate-woven moments is to embrace them and allow them to mould you anew. Then, what at first may seem disastrous and perverse, becomes wondrous.
I have not the stomach for any more of your lies.
Though it had no face, the demon radiated disappointment, as though Ahriman had failed to grasp some fundamental truth.
Very well,
it said, rising from the bench.
But consider all the fate-woven moments in your own life, and think on where and when you might have embraced them to know miracles.
There is a flaw in your reasoning, said Ahriman. Your talk of embracing these changes only works with the benefit of hindsight. I suspect they would not be so easy to recognize in moments of crisis.
We shall see,
said the demon.
You think I seek to betray you. Perhaps I do. But you should know I am not the only scorpion on your back.
Ahriman turned from the demon.
Get off my damn bridge, he said.
Jambik Sosruko placed 4 delicate cups on the table, 2 on either side of a painted ceramic pot. Tales of heroes were rendered in hair-fine strokes of pale blue oxide around the pot's circumference, and such was the artist's skill that their rise and fall could be followed in endlessly repeating cycles. Yasu Negasena let his eyes follow the epic scenes painted on the pot, struggling to conceal his surprise at the master of the Arethusa's shocking appearance. The sigilite had, of course, informed him of Magos Uexkul's affliction, but to see what it had done to him in the flesh was something else entirely. The shipmaster's body was an immobile revenant of mummified flesh, but Nagasena remembered him entirely differently. 4 years had passed since he had last seen Uexkul, 4 years in which degenerating motor neurons had unravelled autonomous control of his body.
A full-body gibbet harness enclosed his useless limbs, and a network of electrostimulation cables, mechanized lungs, and gurgling intravenous tubes sustained his atrophied physique. A humming MIU implant replaced the entire rear half of his skull and afforded him locomotive control of the harness, but nothing close to the smooth ease he had once known. Uexkul's face was fixed and expressionless, but his eyes, still organic after all he had endured, remained alive with fierce intelligence.
"Greetings, Yasu," said Uexkul,
his synthetic voice also a ghost of its former glory.
"I have one rule. Do not pity me. My body is much changed, true, but I am still me. I would consider it a grave insult were you to view or treat me otherwise."
"As you wish," said Nagasena, turning his attention to Diopromus, unarmored but entirely formidable in a body glove and slate-grey chiton. His flinty gaze was unwavering, but Nagasena felt no intimidation. They had crossed paths twice before, and though neither had been in any hurry for a third encounter, Malkador cared nothing for their reservations. Promus did not speak, his attention focused on Nagasena's three companions. The first was a legionary with alabaster skin marred by childhood brand marks and a shadow of black hair. His name was Antarka Saivan, and had once been a librarian of the Raven Guard. Now he wore the bare-brushed steel of a knight without a legion. The equal of Promus in scale, Saivan somehow managed to appear slender in comparison to the former ultramarine. Nagasena's eyes narrowed as he saw Promus would not return Saivan's gaze. Promus sensed the scrutiny, and his eyes filled with ice. The second and third of Nagasena's companions came as a pair, though for all they were apart, they might as well be counted as a single being. Lady Valeda was a congenital dwarf, with wrinkled nut-brown skin and the open features of the Indoi Kush. No one knew her true age, but she claimed to have witnessed the lightning-bearer raise the eagle at the Declaration of Unity, and Nagasena believed her. She sat to his left, short fingers tapping an irregular tattoo on the polished surface of the table, as if to music only she could hear. Lastly, Jambik Sosruko was Lady Valeda's protector, an ochre-skinned giant clad in furs and twisted iron rings. A gene-stock Migu from Nai Mongol, his dexterity and cognitive capacity had been augmented with a bulky synaptic crown, making him the very image of a savage king from ancient days. The staterooms of the Arethusa were spacious, but two space marines and an ogre made it small. The walls and ceiling were polished marble and chromed steel, shimmering with hololithic representations of industrial schematics. A gleaming auslite table of veined black ran the length of the room like a toppled monolith. A cold space, but a functional one. A mechanicum one. An escort of gold-armored thalaxi had met Nagasena and his retinue in one of the upper embarkation decks. The vaulted industrial space was noisy and dense with groaning lifter rigs and maniples of battle automata, standing like the entombed statues of the first Thearch of the Dragonlands. The thalaxi led them through a series of enameled corridors, stenciled in lingua technis to the upper staterooms where the masters of the Arethusa waited. A host of biologist thralls kept to the far wall of the stateroom. One stood conspicuously apart from Uexkul's medikai detail, a slight figure draped in scarlet robes and fitted with a mask of whirring loops. Glancing nervously at Promus, his fingers clacked and ratcheted like an exactor's counting machine. Majos Zygman Videns, statistical prognosticator.
"Why are you here, Nagasena?" said Promus,
finally breaking the silence.
"Always so direct, Dio," said Nagasena,
adjusting the sword at his hip, a long, elegantly curved blade housed in a scabbard of lacquered wood, jade and mother-of-pearl. Its name was Shujiki, which meant honesty in a long-dead language.
"These are direct times."
"Indeed they are,"
said Nagasena, gesturing to the fragrant coils of steam rising from the pot.
"But not so direct as to absolve us of common courtesies.
Promus shook his head. I have no time for your rituals. Nagasena leaned forwards, and when he spoke, his tone was freighted with authority.
Then make time.
Promus and Uexkul understood from whence came that authority, and Nagasena reached over to pour the tea. First into the cups before his hosts, then into his own and that of Lady Valeda. Uexkul would not drink, of course, but not to offer him refreshment would be an unforgivable breach of etiquette. Nagasena waited for Promus to lift his cup before taking a drink himself.
It is good, said Promus. Very good.
It should be,
said Nagasena.
It is a blend synthesized by Lady Valeda from a fragment of the Kissa Yojoki.
I understood that text to be lost, said Promus.
It was long thought to have been burned in Narthen Doom's Night of Unremembering, yes, agreed Nagasena.
How is it you obtained a copy?
Asked Uexkul.
Conservatory teams, said Lady Valeda in her broken Gothic. Working on fringes of Boish and War Theatre. Uncover partial copy before Yselti finally exhaust Empress patience.
She grinned at Promus and said,
Pages brought to Malkador before your kind take field. Lucky for us. Legions not kind to the past.
Promus grunted and replaced his cup on the tabletop.
You have nothing more vital to do than resurrecting lost teas.
Of course, said Nagasena. But sometimes the means to restore body and soul must be indulged. After Nykea, you of all people should understand the concept of balance. A mind cannot focus on death all the time.
Clearly you have not been keeping abreast of the campaigns waged by Horus and his fellow traitors, said Promus.
You are entirely wrong in that assumption, said Nagasena.
Is it news you bring? Asked Uexkul. Does the Emperor move against the War Master?
He does, said Nagasena,
unwilling to speak of the mission to the vengeful spirit and what it had cost. But that is not why you are here, said Promus, is it?
No. I require your assistance in another matter.
What matter?
The Sigilite requires us to travel to the orbital jail of Kamitisona and interrogate three prisoners.
Kamitisona, said Promus, a look of distaste crossing his pronounced features. No, I think not. Nagasena sighed and took a drink of his tea, an invigorating Ryuku cha, said to enhance the rejuvenating properties of the five vital organs. He used the pause to gather his thoughts and choose his next words carefully.
These are no ordinary prisoners, he said.
Legion? Asked Promus.
Mortals, but ones of especial significance, said Nagasena.
Why do you require the Arethusa?
Asked Uexkul, the gibbet harness hissing as he gestured to Antarka Saivan and Jambik Sosruko.
You have a ship and warriors of your own?
The mechanistic nature of Arethusa's fighting forces makes it a singularly suitable choice for this mission.
Why?
Because the Sigilite believes we will not be the only ones seeking to learn what these prisoners know.
Who else might be looking?
Survivors of the 15th Legion, said Nagasena.
Promus grunted mirthlessly.
The Thousand Sons are dead. The Wolf King saw to that.
Laemon Russ was thorough. But it seems the Crimson King escaped his final judgment.
How could you possibly know that? Demanded Promus.
Malkador assures me the information comes from an unimpeachable source, said Nagasena,
who had asked that self-same question and received a similarly nebulous answer.
An unimpeachable source? That is all you will give us?
It is all I know, said Nagasena.
Malkador and his secrets will be the death of us all, said Promus, shaking his head.
Very well, Yesu.
Tell me more of these prisoners. Who are they exactly?
I am given to understand they were once remembrances, said Nagasena. Their vessel was taken as it fled Prospero's destruction.
If they were fleeing Prospero, then they are servants of the Crimson King, snapped Promus. What do you think they know?
I do not know for certain. Something relating to the nature of Primarch Magnus would be my guess, said Nagasena. That the sons of the Crimson King desire this too
is surely reason to reach these prisoners first. Yes? Magus Uexkul leaned forwards.
Malkador intends to finish what the Wolf King began.
You may be right, said Nagasena. Then you will need more than cybernetic warriors, said Promus, standing and leaning with his fists pressed down on the table. Men of iron whose courage is forged upon the anvil will not be enough. Nagasena nodded.
That is why I brought men of ice